This mortal coil.
So let's laugh for 10 seconds and then I'll just sort of clap my hands and then we're going to do breathing, okay? Okay, 10 seconds, it's nothing. Let's go.
That is okay. The sound of laughter yoga. And laughter and its effect on our bodies and our minds can help with recovery, relieve anxiety, and make us feel better about life, says laughter yoga coach Roz Ben-Mosher. Roz should know. She was diagnosed with bowel cancer at the age of 42, and Roz thinks appreciating the funny side of life despite our hardship can build resilience and lead to a happier, healthier life. Roz, thank you so much for coming on Nightlife tonight.
Thank you so much for having me, Mel.
Now, Roz, you've written a very moving story about a function you had to attend the night before your surgery for cancer a few years ago. Can you tell us about what happened?
Well, it was one of these things. I was sort of still relatively new in the laughter yoga world and I was excited to have been given a booking for a ladies' lingerie laughter party. And months prior to the booking, you know, I was so excited. But, you know, a few days prior to surgery, it was the last place in the world that I wanted to be. So I really had to force myself through those doors, put on my happy face. And the extraordinary thing was is that even though, as I say, I sort of went in feeling like I'd sort of been submerged by a ton of bricks. After I sort of explained some of the health benefits of laughter and then we ran, you know, we facilitated the laughter session with these very excited, lovely ladies, I actually realised it was the first time since I'd been given the diagnosis that I felt a little bit lighter and brighter. And I could see also in the people who were participating that, you know, the energy levels had shifted.
Before we go on to talk more about your story, which is a fascinating one, can you tell us a little bit more about laughter yoga? Let's start with, how did you discover laughter yoga?
Sure. I was actually volunteering at a World Health Promotion conference and I as a rapporteur, and in between all of the serious sessions that of course I wanted to be in, there was a 30-minute laughter yoga slot. And I thought, I was quite intrigued. It's like, laughter yoga, what is this? And I was sort of thinking at the time, gee, you know, all the other sessions are 1 hour. I wonder why this one's only 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. Well, after sort of participating in a room sort of with, you know, I think there was probably about 60 plus people, it was such a energetic and slightly sort of wacky practice that by the end of the 30 minutes I realised, wow, I really had a huge infusion of laughter, and I think I don't know if I would have coped with any more.
how does it work? I mean, how does it start? Because it seems like it might be quite a confronting thing to do, to go into a room of people and start laughing together, you know, not in an audience where we're not having to look at each other and we're laughing at somebody on stage or in a film. There's something not quite as confronting about that. There's something, you know, how does it all work?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And I think the last thing that anybody would like is to sort of feel that they were being laughed at or that they were really being silly because, you know, that judgment voice comes in. The way that laughter yoga works is it's brilliant. It's simulated laughter exercises, which is led by a facilitator, together with deep breathing and chanting and clapping, which is with a ho, ho, ha, ha, ha. And the way it works is it's sort of like a layered approach in that you start with this facilitated laughter exercise. Everybody joins in, and in no time, the laughter becomes very real. So even though we sort of start with a simulated experience of laughter, it becomes very real in no time at all. So that really helps to break down sort of any sort of resistance to that sort of notion. It's like, oh, no one sort of told a joke. This isn't naturally very funny. It just necessarily becomes so.
Right. That was what I was going to ask you. A simulated laughter exercise, does that mean you have to tell a great joke? But by the sound of things, it doesn't mean that at all.
No, it's actually using different laughter things. So, for example, you know, the first laugh that, you know, we do generally do in any laughter yoga session would be the greeting laugh. So either you could do sort of the Eastern greeting laugh, and if you can sort of envisage sort of, you know, hands together in the namaste position and you just greet everybody in the circle with a, you know, gentle laughter, greeting everybody. Eye contact is really important. And also just sort of understanding that it's just because it's simulated, if you choose to laugh for, you know, the right reason, you're getting those wonderful health benefits. And as I say, it becomes real in no time at all anyway.
What are the health benefits of laughing?
So many. but physiologically, it's amazing. And actually, together with Latrobe, a university colleague of mine, a couple of years ago, we ran a research program in aged care. And some of the benefits that we found, and these sort of definitely tie in with benefits in larger studies sort of, you know, over the world, is it lowers blood pressure. Mm-hmm. Initially, we found that when people do start laughing, there's a bit of a peak in blood pressure, but then it goes right down. It really, it increases oxygenation. I mean, you try laughing without breathing. You know, you can't. So the more you laugh, the more you breathe. And we all know the benefits of, you know, aerobic exercise. Then there's the things like, you know, those endorphins, those happy hormones that get released even if we have a smile on our face, or even if we really think and feel happy thoughts, they get released when we laugh. Then it helps improve immune function. It just generally is just an extraordinary stress buster. And, you know, when we laugh, we actually get a bit of a gentle body workout. You know, you can actually start to feel your abs and your cheek muscles. And so it's actually a really useful thing to be able to do with people who, for example, have chronic health issues, mm-hmm. or who are less mobile, because essentially you can sit there and laugh and still get that gentle aerobic workout with the added endorphin benefits. So that really, as I say, it's like a whole of body response.
On This Mortal Coil tonight, we're speaking with Roz Ben-Moshe, and we're talking about laughter yoga. We're talking about all sorts of things tonight with Roz, who's has an extraordinary story to tell. Roz, let's go to your own personal story now. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in leafy Blackburn, and then less leafy Borwin in Melbourne.
Right. And what kind of family have you come from?
Oh, right. Well, how long do we have? I was the youngest of four children. Mm-hmm. I would like to say that I was as a gift as opposed to a mistake, because there's quite a big age gap. And
really, how big?
9 years between myself and the next sibling, and then 11 and then 12 and a half.
Oh, my gosh. So you're the baby, big time baby.
Yes. And it was, in terms of, if you were sort of thinking about, you know, religious sort of leanings, came from a progressive Jewish background. So, you know, I suppose the pulse of the home, loosely speaking, was Jewish. My father was a GP, mm-hmm. and had a, you know, busy clinic. So he was sort of, you know, that was his focus. My mum, she worked as a receptionist in various places. So,
So your grandparents actually escaped Nazi Germany. Does that mean that the shadow of the Holocaust, you know, was within the family as you were growing up?
It's very interesting that you ask, in subtle ways. I mean, my mum was very blessed in that she left as a child when she was 8. It was just after Kristallnacht in November 1938. Right. They got the last boats leaving Hamburg, and so she actually never really felt the real terrors of the Holocaust. But it was really interesting. If you went to our house, if you opened our pantry, it was actually a health risk, because tins could just like come out, because the cupboard was always, you know, really piled high with tins. And I sort of used to wonder, why do we have so much canned food? Like, my mum used to always make fresh food. So that was sort of a bit of a legacy, sort of you just never know what could happen. There was, I suppose, a low level of anxiety that I think appreciate now, that was always evident, you know, the fact that, you know, we had locks on our windows. We always locked our doors. Mm-hmm. It's like in those days, it wasn't necessarily something that people would think of needing to do.
And was it something that your grandparents talked about at all?
No.
Right.
It's very interesting if you would have met them. Firstly, my grandparents on my mother's side, so from the German side, they made a point of not speaking a word of German in public once they got here. Right. So they had barely a trace of an accent, which is extraordinary. And then on my dad's side, and they came from Poland, they spoke Yiddish at home, but again, tried as much as possible to converse in English.
That's so interesting. I wonder what that does, particularly for the German side of the family, to erase your language like that, you know, to take on another language so entirely. I wonder what that does.
Well, my grandfather was actually quite a talented linguist. I believe he spoke over five languages. So for him, it was less of an issue. However, I know that, that really cultured German language and that highly attuned German language, I don't believe ever sort of reciprocated into English. So I think, yeah, exactly. It's a means of communication. It definitely would impact on one's self-esteem, one's self-worth, and just sort of feeling different to everybody else. Whereas before, you know, you were very much, you know, that was just your method of communication.
So was Judaism part of your growing up? Were your parents spiritual people?
Well, probably going back to your last question, now I think about it, as a legacy of the Holocaust, my dad actually was a proud atheist.
Right.
He sort of would indulge my mum by attending sort of the temple, the Leo Beck Centre, where we were members, on high holy days. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as far as he was concerned, there was no God. As for my mum, she came from a lineage where they were actually involved in setting up the liberal congregation in Hamburg. So there was a long sort of a connection to the progressive, that liberal Judaism. So that, I suppose, was inculcated to us. So from an early age, I, like my siblings, went to Sunday school. And then from there, I got very involved in the reform youth movement called Netzer. So that was very, very part and parcel of who I was. It was a very important, very, very important to me. And in fact, I remember when I actually had my bat mitzvah, one of the differences between an Orthodox community and a progressive community, especially when I was younger, was that if you were a female, you didn't read from the Torah, you know, one of the, you know, the books of Moses. Whereas, you know, I very proudly led the whole service, read from the Torah, and, you know, had visions that, oh, maybe one day I'll become a rabbi. So yeah, wow, it was important to me.
and as you grew up and matured into adulthood, did it continue to be a big part of your life?
Yes. Sort of, you know, went to live in Israel for a bit and then came back. It's always a part of who I am. Mm-hmm. So even though I suppose the congregations that I've belonged to or how I express my Judaism has evolved over the years. In a way, it's sort of, you know, in my younger years, the Judaism, certainly in terms of, you know, connection to a synagogue, was through connection with a prayer book. When I suppose, especially, you know, when I was given the bowel cancer diagnosis, I sort of left the prayer book behind and I just sort of turned to my own inner sort of dialogue with God, the universe, and just really deeply connecting on that sort of Jewish soul level.
What actually led you to have an interest in I never know whether to say Kabbalah or Kabbalah, because I've heard it so many different ways. I remember in the 90s and the 2000s, it was like the kind of religion du jour at the time. You know what I mean? With all these movie stars taking part with their little red bangles and things like that.
Yes.
So you've actually spent time with – do you say Kabbalah or Kabbalah?
I say Kabbalah, but Kabbalah. it's fine.
what is Kabbalah in relation to a more traditional Jewish faith? Like, where does the Kabbalah come from and go to?
Oh, you really need to get a rabbi on to answer that question. But
probably
I will do it. I won't do it justice. I won't do it justice. But essentially, Kabbalah sort of is I suppose, the spiritual qualities of Judaism. It sort of has things, you know, talking about, you know, the Zohar or the Tree of Life, mm-hmm. or you know, the different aspects of the divine and the soul world, which is sort of a bit different to the traditional prayers that one reads in the prayer book. So the reason why there's sort of a gap in knowledge about what Kabbalah is that in days gone by, Kabbalah could only be learnt by men over the age of 40.
Right.
And so because of those restrictions, over time it sort of it just became less and less, and that sort of that more, I suppose, religious sort of rigor sort of came into, I suppose, more of the mainstream. And it's really, you know, as you say, probably in the last 20 or so years that started to get a bit of a revival. And now, you know, people worldwide are actually, you know, being, you know, having the benefits of learning about some of the wonderful attributes mm-hmm. To which it offers. But it's really, as I say, I'm really not doing it justice, but it's connecting to that spiritual, that really spiritual dimension to Judaism, which tends to have been, rightly or wrongly, a bit overshadowed by mainstream orthodoxy.
And what
I might
is it,
get in trouble for saying that.
Right. What is it that has, how has it enriched your life?
Well, for me personally, I think that there's a level of meaning to which, you know, I wouldn't have gained had I not been mm-hmm. exposed to some of its teachings. So just the whole notion that this world and the world that we live in, this is just not all that it is about, that there is, you know, that soul world, that there is that spiritual mm-hmm. connection. For example, just in terms of my diagnosis, when I first got the diagnosis of bowel cancer, I was really just so taken. Yeah, just didn't, you know, I suppose, you know, the wind was really knocked from my sails,
yeah,
and so one of the first ports of call was I actually went to a rabbi that I really hold in very high esteem, Rabbi Label Wolf, who is the spiritual director of Spirit Grow Mindfulness Meditation Center and really quite a renowned Kabbalah rabbi, and he, for example, gave the interesting perspective on my diagnosis. So I had a malignant polyp in my rectum. And one of the insights that he offered to me was that this, from a spiritual perspective, sort of indicated that there was a block between my higher self and my lower self, and that you know, and some people might sort of thinking, well, that really doesn't make much sense. But to me, it really did, because to me, I was sort of, you know, already sort of thinking about in terms of laughter and my higher self and my, you know, my mm-hmm. purpose in life. You know, we all have a purpose in life and what mine was. And I was sort of really grappling with that versus, you know, some of the more mundane aspects of my life. So just little insights like that that, as I say, that that Kabbalah and that philosophy really offers.
So with this, the diagnosis that you've talked about and that link to spirituality, has it been your spirituality that's helped you get through this with such positivity? I mean, you've got such, or you know, you've got the love. It's like you had all the tools ready by the sound of things to be able to negotiate this positively. But then who knows how they're going to deal with this kind of diagnosis ever?
Correct. And I just before I even address this, I have to just state it very clear that cancer is no laughing matter. Mm-hmm. You know, there's just nothing funny about it. The challenge, though, in our life is when we are facing adversity, whether it be a cancer diagnosis, whether it be a divorce, whether it be, you know, you're fired from your work. It's about, you know, what sort of techniques, what tools we can sort of bring to sort of help us move from a position of adversity to positivity. And people might sort of say, well, why would we want to do that? The thing is that a lot of people, I suppose, have that perception. It's like they try, you know, to be positive. It's not about that. It's actually about using these strategies to enhance healing, to actually help change the brain chemistry in order to allow us to heal, in order to now enable us to process some of these challenging times. So, for example, with myself, you know, one of the things that was really important was actually the pen, the power of the pen. You know, I immediately took to paper to help try and make sense of what was going on with me. And that enabled a little bit of distance between my lived experience and just provided a bit of a perspective. And in terms of that sort of spiritual, strengthening, For whatever reason, from very, very early on, I sort of made a commitment to myself, almost in a sort of like biblical sense, that come what may, I was going to, put this, you know, towards, you know, creating, you know, the greater good, so other people could also draw on these things to enable their own well-being. So in my book, Laughing at Cancer, How to Heal with Love, Laughter and Mindfulness, it's actually a bit of a dialogue between myself and this future envisaged readership, because I was thinking, okay, the specifics, the individual particulars of my own journey are going to be different to other people, but there are a whole lot of universal messages out there that came about from my journey. So, you know, if something doesn't feel right to you, you know, can you reframe it by infusing it with a little bit of positivity? Can you actually think about perhaps in time something unanticipated that may have resulted in a bit of lightness? You know, it's not just about physical laughter. It's actually about a broader philosophy of how one infuses and amplifies the positivity in every aspect of your life. So reframing is really powerful. Smiling is really powerful. Mm. You know, it's like a circuit breaker. You can actually change your whole physiology by placing a heartfelt smile on your face and really absorbing that and pausing and letting it soak in really, really deep. You can obviously laughter is a great thing, but the challenge with laughter is that most people, when going through adversity, laughter is the last thing that is associated, yeah, you know, with any form of adversity. So how do you actually create opportunities, not leave it to chance, it won't happen, but create opportunities to laugh? So whether that's, you know, joining a laughter club if you you know, have the physical energy or inclination to do so, whether it's choosing to watch comedy over, you know, I nickname news, you know, doom and gloom, how do you choose to spend your time? Do you choose to spend your time with people that actually bore you, your spirits, or do you actually choose to spend time with people who you know, make you more anxious or more fearful? So it's about, you know, what sort of commitment we make to ourselves. It's really about a choice. And the more that one chooses to, be grateful about, the small things in life. You know, Dr. Barbara Fredrickson talks about micro moments of joy. Very early on into the bowel cancer diagnosis, I decided every single day I was going to find micro moments of joy. And so small things that went well in my day, you know, Professor Martin Seligman talks about, you know, three good things. These are evidence-based strategies that sound too good to be true, really. But what this actually does is over time, it rewires your brain to seek out the positive. And the more that you actually look for the positive, the more you actually look for the good, the more good you see, the more good you feel, the more it's a really powerful concept.
So, Roz, with this positivity, this lightness and this connection to people that, you know, buoy you rather than cause more anxiety, and we should make sure we're saying, make clear we're saying buoy rather than bore. They're so close.
B-U-O-Y.
Yeah. So close.
Imagine it sitting on the horizon of a sea.
How are you doing now?
I am doing well, but I mean, the reality is that, I mean, anybody who has any form of surgery, so, you know, I have a brand new rectum. Not too many people can say that. And,
wow.
You know, I lost 30 centimetres of my bowel. So, gosh. You know, any operation comes with, I suppose, consequences. So in some regards, I would say I'm weaker, but then in other regards, I'm so much stronger. Mm-hmm. And as I say, that commitment right back then when I chose to focus on wellness rather than illness, mm-hmm. when I chose to sort of focus on things that would actually, you know, make me feel good as opposed to all of those F words, those fear, the frustration, you know, I still to this day, it has become much more of an unconscious process. So that's the whole thing about any of these things that I'm talking about is change does not happen overnight. It requires a level of commitment and it requires a level of practice. Whatever you practice gets, you know, grows stronger. So if you practice fear, worry, stress, anxiety, you get really good at it. But if you start to practice things like gratitude, things like smiling, things like reframing, things like, you know, just, you know, all those things that we're thankful for or that do go well, we are actually, you know, we actually get really good at it. So I think that over the years, slowly, I've sort of been able to recognize, to be able to draw on whatever tools I need at a given interval to respond to a particular event. Because the reality is that none of us can control our external circumstances, but we all have the power to control our internal environment. We all have that. And that is a really important message that often people are disempowered when they become overwhelmed by challenges and adversity, but we have to sort of be able to tune in to our innate knowingness, to our innate healer, and empower that. And the more we do so, the more that's going to have a flow-on effect into our everyday life.
Roz, thank you so much for joining us on This Mortal Coil tonight.
Oh, such a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to Nightlife with Melanie Tate on ABC Radio.